For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
So we're in the second half of 1 Thessalonians. It's this really practical section of this letter that the Apostle Paul wrote back to some of his friends in this city of Thessalonica. These were all really new Christians. And, you know, he had been pulled away from his time with them early, unexpectedly, before he was done teaching them and explaining some things to them. And so he's written this letter to them to try to fill in some of the gaps on the things that he had missed, and also in response to some reports that he had heard on how this church was doing, which, by the way, they were doing awesome. And yet he tells them several times in this section, you guys are doing awesome, but you need to excel still more. Excel still more. And so tonight, as we move into, he's talked about some sexual problems they were having there. He's also talked about some confusion they had with regard to death and the end of the world. Now he's going to talk about Christian leadership. And the rest of this letter, it's just kind of a series of commands and instructions. And, you know, one verse might not seem that related to the next one, but we're going to spend a couple of weeks talking our way and studying our way through these. So tonight we're just going to break off these two verses right here. Chapter 5, verses 12 and 13 about Christian leadership. He says, but we request of you, brethren, that you appreciate those who diligently labor among you and have charge over you in the Lord and give you instruction, and that you esteem them very highly because of their work. Live in peace with one another. Okay, so that's all we're going to cover tonight. And what this really is, you can see, he says, we request of you that you appreciate your leaders. And then he says at the beginning of verse 13, he asks that you esteem those leaders highly. And what this is a call for is this is a call to understand or appreciate the leaders that they had in this group here. And this is really understanding and appreciating leadership in the Christian context. You see, the world has its own idea of leadership. And when we talk about leadership in the context of Christianity, there's really two extremes that need to be avoided. One is what Jesus calls leading like the Gentiles. And the classic passage on this is Mark chapter 10, where his disciples are anticipating Jesus' arrival in Jerusalem. This is 3 years into Jesus' ministry. They had the sense that something big is going to happen when we get to Jerusalem. They were thinking Jesus is finally going to set up his kingdom, and they were arguing among one another about who was better than whom. Who was going to be at the top? You know, it's like they're fighting for the best government positions in Jesus' new dominant worldwide government. And Jesus has to sit them all down and explain to them they're totally confused with their perspective on leadership. He says, you know that those who are recognized as rulers of the Gentiles, and that was just his word for everybody else, the rest, everyone else, not you guys, certainly. Those who are recognized as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great men exercise authority over them. But, he says, it is not this way among you. Whoever wishes to become great among you must become your servant. Whoever wishes to be first among you shall be slave of all. So instead of the idea that, you know, we're going to be the 1%, we're going to be at the top of the food chain, we're going to be able to basically have everybody else be our servants to serve me, to do what I want. I have the power to take from anybody else. Jesus says, no, actually, you've got it completely backward. Leadership in Jesus' context, in his way of thinking, and in God's way of thinking, is service. In fact, becoming a servant, becoming the slave of all. That's what he says leadership is, as far as he was concerned. And he points to his own example. He says, even the Son of Man, talking about himself, did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. So when Jesus left heaven to come to earth, he didn't show up born into the palace with everybody waiting on him hand and foot. Instead, he was born into the most humble of circumstances, a peasant with nothing special about his appearance, poor, manual laborer his whole life, and one who was consumed with serving other people. And ultimately, the ultimate act of service, really the climax of his life, the time that he spent here on earth, and the thing that he was about to do when he went into Jerusalem, was to die on the cross. to give his life as a ransom or as a payment for many. You see, that's what Jesus came to do. This is the ultimate act of leadership where he gave up everything to become nothing, to be tortured to death, and to die the death of a criminal so that you and I, the real criminals, the real, what the Bible calls sinners, the real people, people who have done wrong, who's violated God's perfect standard, so that we could be forgiven. It says, by his stripes, we were healed. By the wounds on his back, God has made us whole. And so Jesus says, I came to give my life as a ransom for many. And I'm calling on you who have experienced my leadership to then turn and to lead like me, to live like me. And so Christian leadership is not one where we put our feet up and we start barking orders for people to come around and wait on us. It's one where we are exhausting ourselves to love other people, to give my life completely for other people, because no matter how much I give, it's still nowhere close to what Jesus gave for me. And so it's all just a response to his love. It's all just a dim reflection of the brilliant reality that he showed us. So we want to avoid leading like the Gentiles, and you'll see that that really comes out here in this passage on leadership as we look into it. He's speaking against that attitude, but he's also speaking against a rejection of leadership here as well. This may have been a problem in this group. You know, it was such a young group. They would have, their practice was to appoint leaders, to put leaders in place before they left. It's unclear how officially they had done this before they were whisked away in the middle of the night. In the wake of persecution. But, it would have been tempting for this Christian community, you know, where the people who had been Christians for 6 months were the leaders of the people who had been Christians for 3 months or whatever. It would have been tempting for them to be like, you know, whatever, why do we have to listen to you? You know, aren't we all equal in Christ? And so a rejection of leadership would have been out of the question here as well. F.F. Bruce talks about their practice of appointing leaders. He says, the policy of Paul and his colleagues seems to have been to wait until qualities of spiritual leadership displayed themselves in certain members of the church. So they would, you know, they would get in there and then they'd watch to see how the different people were relating to one another. They would look for people that were serving, that were earning the respect of the other people, not by, you know, being arrogant and by talking down, but by getting under them, by taking the lower seat. He says, and then they would urge the others to acknowledge and respect those as leaders. So these were just believers who were a little bit more spiritually mature than the rest of the group, and what they said was, see these people here, they're pretty good. You should listen to them. We trust them, and you should too. One of the most obvious qualities of leadership was a readiness to serve the church and to care for its needs. Such leaders did not do the appropriate work because they had been recognized as leaders. No, they were recognized as leaders because they were seen to be doing the work. The title is given after the work has been done for quite some time. You know, to recognize someone as a Christian leader is not to make them a leader. Okay, God is the one that makes people leaders. As people, really, the leaders rise to the surface in any given group, the spiritual leaders. You know, the job of the leaders of a church is to recognize other leaders. Or in Paul's case, where he's starting a church, the church planter is to recognize leaders in this group. You know, these are not parents, okay? These are not people that take responsibility for every single part of this of the lives of the people in the church. That would be taking way too much responsibility for spiritual leaders to take. Sure, you know, we read some parenting metaphors back in chapter 3 and chapter 2 where he says, you know, like a mother, like a nursing mother, I was just tenderly caring for you. Or like a father, I was admonishing you and exhorting you to walk in the right way. And so, you know, there are some aspects of parenting here. There are analogies and similarities, but it is not parenting where we're taking complete responsibility for the well-being of the others, you know, like a parent would for their toddler. They're also not priests or clergy, what he's talking about here. It's not like these people have special access to God or you've got to come to them to come to God. You know, when the New Testament talks about priests, it says you have one priest, Jesus Christ. Or, viewed in another sense, everybody's a priest. Everybody has direct access to God and the ability to pray for one another and to, you know, have a spiritual influence in each other's lives. But the idea of a special class of Christians that are like, you know, more special or something like that, or through whom others have to pass to get to God, or a special class of Christians that do all the work in the church, all the work in the Christian community, that is a completely foreign concept to the New Testament. And so we should reject any notion of leadership that argues for that. And of course, the authority here is limited in its scope. He says, he refers in this same verse to those who have charge over you in the Lord. And so there are certain areas where spiritual leaders have responsibility. You know, I would not be going through, you know, your checkbook and talking to you about how you're spending your money. But, you know, the spiritual leader does have some say over what goes on at, the Christian meetings like this. You know, this is not a democracy where we all vote on what we want to do at CT each week. This is one where there are spiritual leaders. I guess I'm one of those, but there's a group of us. We don't lead alone. We lead in teams here. And, there's a group of us that try to decide what's going to be best for this meeting here, what's going to be best for this ministry that, you know, I and some others are responsible for overseeing. And he goes on to describe really three pictures of servant leadership. He says, appreciate those who do these three things. And as you can see here, the respect is earned long before the title is granted. He even says, highly esteem them because of their work. And so we're looking for, you know, who is becoming mature. There are character requirements, you know, where your character needs to be a certain way, you know, reliable, trustworthy, faithful, loving person. And so you're looking for people like that. You're also looking for people who really are serving and loving other people. Who do people feel loved by? Who do people feel served by? And so the respect is earned by the group long before the title is bestowed on the person. So let's go ahead and look through these. First of all, he says, those who diligently labor among you. That's the first picture of a spiritual leader, a servant leader. And he's already used this word to labor. He used it of himself, of his own tent making, where he got a job while he was there at Thessalonica. He says, you recall, brethren, our labor and hardship, how working night and day, we didn't want to be a burden to any of you. And so Paul says, we are working hard day and night so that we didn't have to take any money from you guys because we just wanted to be there for you. We didn't want you to be there for us. And so they worked hard so they could be givers to this community. He also used it with regard to his own ministry. He says, you know, we were afraid the tempter might have tempted you and our labor would be in vain. All of the time that we spent with you, all the love that we showed you, the blood and the sweat and the tears that we poured out for you. He says, we were afraid that labor might be in vain. If God's enemy, Satan, got in with you and began to twist your thinking toward us and toward God and might lead you down a path that you might never recover from. John Stott says that this word normally refers to manual occupations. It means to toil, to strive, to struggle, and to grow weary in doing so. It conjures up pictures of rippling muscles and pouring sweat. Paul applied it to various farm labors and to the physical exertions of his own tent making. But he also used it in relation to his apostolic labors, the hard work of his colleagues, and to those who labor in preaching and teaching. He's saying, you know, serving God is really hard work. It's exhausting. Some people are really surprised when they serve the Lord and they find themselves worn out. No, that's a good sign. If you're not worn out, there's something wrong. Oswald Sanders puts it this way. He says, those who lead the church are marked by a willingness to give up personal preferences, to surrender legitimate and natural desires for the sake of God. Bruce Barton quotes a sign at a service station. It says, we will crawl under your car oftener and get ourselves dirtier than any of our competition. That's the kind of service the Christian seeks to give. They're like, whatever you need done, whatever needs to happen here, I am here to serve, no matter how menial the task seems. The demands of leadership, he says, wear down the robust person. But Christians know where to find renewal. You know, that's one of the things as a spiritual leader that you need to learn how to do is it is exhausting, you know, kind of like working out in the fields for 12 hours a day back in Paul's day. You know, he's using manual labor terms here. It is exhausting. But he says one of the things the leader needs to do is he needs to learn how to find refreshment, needs to learn how to depend on God for his strength. If a Christian is not willing to rise early and work late, to expend greater effort in diligent study and faithful work, that person will not change a generation. Fatigue is the price of leadership. Mediocrity is the result of never getting tired. Guess if you want to live a mediocre life, and if you want your spiritual impact to be relatively mediocre, then you probably will not get that worn out serving the Lord. But if you really want to have an impact for God, that's going to mean you get pretty worn out at times. I mean, of course, we do need rest. You know, it's kind of surprising. I talk to leaders sometimes who feel like it's sinful to like ever stop serving God, to ever take a break. You know, it's like every minute of every day of every week is just, they try to book that with service for God. And what ends up happening is by trying to just hit, by pressing the gas all the time, by hitting your adrenaline button all the time, you basically end up running out of gas. And you can't really go hard when you need to go hard because you need a rest. And so that's why I try to schedule time each week of just downtime where I don't have anything scheduled. I just do whatever refreshes me during that time. I think it's also good to get away periodically from everything else. You know, spending a week at the beach I think is a great idea, like we're going to do here shortly. But we need rest. And that's fine. And that's part of what he's talking about where he says the spiritual leader knows where to find refreshment. It would be tragic to serve the Lord just zealously for 3 years and then to never serve him again the rest of your life because you're so burned out. And yet, so what this allows us to do is, at least for me, I know that I've got a block of time on Sundays where I got nothing scheduled. And that kind of allows me to really just go as hard as I possibly can because I know I got a rest coming up. Wesley Duell, in his book, A Blaze for God, has several really good quotes on this. He says, "You are called to give yourself for the church. Christ was willing to give himself even to death for it. You may not be called upon to make that extreme a sacrifice, but Paul was willing to suffer whatever it took, even unto death." This is all a response to the call of Christ. He says, "As I have done, so you go and do likewise." He says, "No student is greater than his master." And he says, you need to love one another like I'm loving you. And the greatest love that one can show is to give one's life for one's friends. He says, this can be difficult. Are you tempted at times to say of some people, who do they think I am? Am I like their servant? You think I'm like just here to serve you? And he says, yeah. Paul says, for Jesus' sake, we become in many respects servants of the church. And what a nobler aspiration could there be than to pour out my life for the church, the bride of Christ, whom he purchased with his own blood, who Jesus loves to his own death. Like he said to the apostle Peter at the end of his life, after Peter had betrayed Jesus, he says, Peter, do you love me? And Peter says, yes, Lord, I do. And Jesus says, then feed my sheep. Feed my lambs, feed my sheep. He says it three times. Love my people that I'm leaving here to accomplish the mission, the most important mission that I gave everything for, that I gave my life as a ransom for many. So a spiritual leader, a servant leader, is one who diligently labors among the people. And so again, it's among you. It's not like over, above, standing aloof, but it's right in there with people, right in there among people. There's no air of snootiness or looking down at people. But he goes on and he says, also these people have charge over you in the Lord. What does that mean? This verb, to have charge over, it refers to the functions of leadership in an army, a state, or a party. A position of this sort involves the task of guarding and responsibility for protection of those over whom one is placed. So there's a certain aspect, there is an aspect almost like there's military connotations to this, but it also really includes aspects of protection, guarding, taking responsibility for people. It says, thus the verb can express the meanings of to support, to care for, and even to concern oneself with. The word literally means to stand before or to stand in front of. Okay, so you can kind of imagine, the leader is the one that kind of stands in front of everyone else that he's leading. You know, it's not someone that's kind of behind using the rest of the troops to shield himself from the battle that's raging, but one that's out in front, leading the charge, leading from the front. F.F. Bruce says it combines the ideas of leading, protecting, and caring for. And so it's almost like kind of like some aspects of like a parent loving and caring for their kids, but also like a general protecting and leading his army, needing to have cooperation from the people he's leading because he cares about them and because he knows there's a mission here that we got to accomplish. And I just love this idea of standing out in front of. I don't know if you guys remember that scene in Spider-Man 2 with the train, where this train is speeding down the tracks to its certain doom, and the train is just totally loaded. It's just full of people. They can't hit the brakes. Of course, the bridge is out ahead, like usual. The brakes don't work. And, you know, he's just there at the front of the train with all the people behind him, and they're like, what are you going to do? And so, you know, first he kind of like hops down and tries to dig his heels into the wooden planks on the tracks, and the wood just goes flying everywhere. And so then he just starts shooting webs along all the buildings on either side of it and just holding on and basically just being stretched by this train and trying to just through sheer force just get the thing to stop before it goes off the bridge. And I like that picture of leadership because it's just completely focused on the people behind him, even though they were kind of mocking him at points. What are you going to do now? And yet he didn't have to do that. And yet he did. He's just pouring himself out completely to the point of exhaustion, to the point where at the end, when the train finally drops, he drops too. But just because he knew there were people there that needed him to do something about it, and he was willing to give up himself for their good. Watchman Nee puts it this way. There was a point in his life where this was right at the end of World War II, right as the communists were taking over in China. And he was away from this church that he was pastor over. And he knew they needed him. He knew he needed to go back there. But the people with him were saying, dude, if you go back there, you're going to get arrested. You're going to get thrown in prison. This is so dangerous. You cannot go back. And here's what he said. He said, I do not care for my life. If the house is crashing down, I have children inside, and I must support it, if need be, with my head. So he says, they need me. I've got to be there. I've got to rescue them. I love them. Their spiritual well-being is what's most important to me. And I don't care. Even if the house falls down on me, I'm going to save my kids. And, you know, sure enough, he got thrown in prison for 20 years. He died in prison. Because he went back to out of love for these people who needed him. It also implies believing in people. And this idea of caring for people, of leading people, of standing out in front, of standing before, you've got to believe in your people. Duell says you never dare react to the disappointing attitudes or actions of some of your people and begin to shut your heart against them. This can be difficult. People hurt you. People don't follow God. People make choices that are harmful to them. Some people decide to walk away from the Lord altogether. He says, you cannot shut your heart against people. Christian leaders must consciously endeavor always to keep their hearts open through love to their people. We saw Paul modeling this earlier in the book about how he says, we were well pleased to impart to you not just the gospel of God, but our very lives. He says, now we really live that we hear that you stand firm in the Lord. Satan may tempt you to give up on your church or group or on some of the people. Maybe some of us are feeling this way right now. You may have to ask God to give you a new and deeper love and faith than you've ever had before. The Holy Spirit is always ready to pour out more of the love of Christ into your heart. You see, this is the lie that we've got to drum this up on our own. We don't realize this is a supernatural task. That God is asking you to do something you could never do. To love people like Christ? I mean, come on. Who are we kidding here? And yet he wants to pour out his love into your heart and so you can become a channel through which his love flows to others. It is often more costly to bring Christians to maturity than it was to bring them to Christ in the first place. This is really where the battle begins a lot of times. We think it's over. They're Christians now. No way. You're just getting started. That's chapter 1. He says, it's not a physical struggle. The agonizing is a spiritual struggle in prayer. an inner price that is paid. That's why Paul compares it to birth pains. You know, he compares it to the most painful experience anyone could ever go through, birth. And he says, you know, it's kind of like that. It's an inner struggle. It's a struggle of prayer a lot of the time. He says many leaders can never be said to wrestle in prayer. Can you? You know, Paul says we're struggling in prayer. We're agonizing for you in prayer. What about you? As a spiritual parent, you will probably wake to spend undisturbed night hours watching and praying for your people, just as a parent sits all night by the bed of a child seriously ill. You become so identified with the ones you love that, like Paul, you carry a constant concern for all in the church. You read about this in 2 Corinthians 11. He goes to this long list of just jarring sufferings that he's been through, like being beaten, flogged, shipwrecked at sea for several nights. And then he says, and apart from all this, I've got the daily pressure of concern for the churches. That's a guy who was engaged with the people whom he was loving. We see this attitude right here, right toward the people in the Thessalonian church. He was so worried. He couldn't stand it any longer. Finally, he was willing to part with even Timothy and Titus to go back and get a report from them. Leadership is costly, time-consuming, energy-consuming work that makes its demands upon you day and night. And that's what Christ calls you to. In response to his love, he calls you to love others that same way. While your prayer for your people is never fully obvious to them, the love invested in prayer for your people becomes apparent in many ways. Our prayer life is what gives us, what allows us to tap into the power of God, into the love of God, so that we can love other people, and people will see. He says, the leader who invests much prayer in his people does not need to announce it to them. That's not the point, to go around telling people you're praying for them. The point is to go around praying for people. And they'll know, they'll sense it, that there's a love there, there's a concern there. That's not this person hasn't thought about me since last week when we hung out, but there's, it's like, you kind of feel like you've been running through their mind. That this person's been taking you before the Lord and praying for you and loving you in that very inconspicuous way of prayer. He says they will sense his loving concern. It will bind their hearts to him. Certainly, prayer is the most powerful way to love people. I mean, it's not the only way. It can't take the place of concrete demonstrations of love, but it's basic to all else, and upon it depends the effectiveness of all else. I don't know if you guys remember this scene in Acts chapter 6, verse 4, if you've ever read this. This is the Jerusalem church. This is the very beginning of the church after the death of Christ. And a fight had broken out. Division had broken out within their group. And the rest of the church came to the apostles, to the leaders of the church, and they said, we need you to resolve this dispute, this argument that we're having. And what the apostles said was, first of all, let's appoint some other leaders to help you work through this problem. And the reason for that is they said, because we need to devote ourselves to the ministry of the word. At least that's what I always thought it said. I read a little bit more closely not too long ago, and I noticed a couple of years back that what they said was, we need to devote ourselves to prayer and the ministry of the word. And I felt pretty convicted. I thought, boy, am I really arranging my schedule, arranging my responsibilities so that I can say the same thing, that I can devote myself to prayer? And I had to admit, no. I had to make some changes in my life as well. Ian Bound says that each leader must be preeminently a man of prayer. His heart must graduate the school of prayer. No learning can make up for the failure to pray. The diploma that you get from the school of prayer is your certification. That is your credentials as a leader. And no learning can overcome that. No earnestness, no diligence, no study, no gifts will supply its lack. This is spiritual leadership. Leadership where we're connected to God, led by God to lead others humbly. Talking to men for God is a great thing, but talking to God for men is greater still. Both are needed from spiritual leaders. He will never talk well and with real success to men for God who has not learned well how to talk to God for men. More than this, prayerless words are deadening words. Our whole lives, our whole efforts to serve God, to lead for Him, they need to have the breath of God's life breathed into them if we're going to be able to impart that life to others. So these leaders, they diligently labor among you. They have charge over you in the Lord. And, he says, you also need to realize the responsibility of giving you instruction. This is our third picture here. This verb, to give you instruction, means to impart understanding, to set right, to lay on the heart. The stress is on influencing not merely the intellect, but the will and the disposition. This is not just imparting of knowledge here to the mind, but this is also influencing the heart, the will. So it acquires senses like to admonish, to warn, to remind, to correct, are ways you'll see this translated. The idea is not that of punishment, but of a moral appeal. And so that leads to change. And in this sense, it takes on the meaning to discipline even. And so this is not just impartation of knowledge, you know, like a calculus teacher droning on and on in front of his class, trying to teach people how to, you know, integrate whatever. But, you know, this is like, you know, this is, for example, the parent that knows that I've got to teach my toddler not to run out into the street or it's going to be bad news. You know, this, the leader, they see that this person doesn't just need knowledge, but they need to have their heart turned in the right direction. And so it might involve pleading, warning, admonishing is another word for this. And so it involves teaching as well as pleading and kind of an emotional component to this as well. This is something that leaders are called on to do, to plead with people. People don't like this sometimes. You know, people, the reason they're headed that way is because they think they're right. And some people aren't humble enough to consider that they might be wrong and that this they might need to head a different direction. And so the leader, instead of just standing passively back and being like, well, I don't know, whatever, it's their life. I mean, ultimately, it is their life, but we don't just sit there and just wash our hands like Pontius Pilate. We get in there with them. We're in there with them enough to where they want to listen to us. And we plead, and we try to instruct. And we try to turn people back from staggering toward death, as it said in Proverbs. And he says that you esteem them very highly in love. So we're appreciating these people, he says, who diligently labor among you, who have charge over you in the Lord, who give you instruction, and that you esteem them very highly in love. And so there's a high honor being attached to these leaders. There's a love here for them. And one lesson we can learn here is that leadership is hard and will draw criticism. There's a reason why Paul's got to say this. It's not because they were just naturally doing this anyway. And you think about the armchair quarterback, all right? You know, it's one thing to sit there in your leather chair with a big bowl of popcorn on your lap, your 50-inch television, and to sit there, you know, with the camera view that shows the whole field and to yell at the quarterback for being such an idiot. You idiot! There was a guy wide open! Okay, it's one thing to do that. It's another thing to actually get down under center, okay? And to peer through this little gap between the top of your helmet and the top of your face mask and to see not just these 6 300-pounders right there lined up ready to tear you limb from limb, but to also see the safety and two more linebackers coming up to the line for an all-out blitz. To stand in there, to snap the ball, to try to lead your team down the field to victory. That's a lot harder than sitting in that leather chair and yelling at the guy who's actually playing the game. Leaders draw criticism. You know, they're kind of the lightning rod for it, and they should be. I mean, they should be taking responsibility. Good leaders don't wonder, boy, who screwed this up? Good leaders say, I'm going to step forward and take responsibility here. They look in the mirror. They don't look out the window when things go wrong. When things go right, they look for who else they can give credit to. But when things go wrong, they're saying, how can I take responsibility here for what happened? And it's just a fact of leadership. And it's something that Paul is trying to lean against. Paul knew how hard leadership was. He's trying to lean against this tendency. He's trying to get their audience to lean against this tendency to get them to understand what leadership really involves and try to get them to esteem and even love their leaders who are doing their best. You know, no leader is perfect. That's part of the reason why they get criticism. It's because they screw up. Swindoll says this. He says, anyone who steps into the arena of leadership must be prepared to pay a price. True leadership exacts a heavy toll on the whole person. And the more effective the leadership, the higher the price. The leader must soon face the fact that he will be the target of critical darts. Unpleasant though it may sound, you haven't really led until you've become familiar with the stinging barbs of the critic. Good leaders must have thick skin. He actually quotes this great quote from Teddy Roosevelt. Some of you may have heard this before. Roosevelt says, it's not the critic who counts, not the man who points out how the strong man stumbles or where the doer of deeds could have done better. The credit, he says, belongs to the man who's actually in the arena, whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood, who strives valiantly, who errs and comes up short again and again because, he says, there's no effort without error or shortcoming. He knew this well as president of the United States. Anybody who's ever tried to lead knows well that if you want to accomplish anything significant, you know, you're right on the knife's edge. There may be some victories, but there's going to be some mistakes that you're going to make. But who knows the great enthusiasms, the great devotions, who spends himself or herself for a worthy cause, who at the best knows in the end the triumph of high achievement, and who at the worst, if he fails, at least fails while daring greatly, so that his place shall never be with those cold and timid souls who knew neither victory nor defeat. He says, at least the leader has tried. At least the leader has stepped out there. At least the leader has gotten his hands dirty and sweaty and bloody in his exertion for something noble and great. And for the critic that just sits there and says, oh, you're doing this wrong. Oh, you're doing that wrong. You have no idea what you're talking about. You have no right to speak. Why don't you step forward and do something rather than just sit around criticizing your leaders all the time? Why don't you know the joy of actually taking a risk and maybe failing, maybe succeeding, but whatever, knowing that at least you tried? You're going to stand before the Lord someday and just be like, well, I never really tried because I didn't want to screw up. I hope not. That's why Christ came to die, so that we didn't have to just play it safe and never even take a chance of failing. So we know we step out in the security and the courage that comes from knowing we're forgiven and secure with Him. My experience with this, you know, I remember living in a house with a bunch of other guys, and the guy who was the leader in that ministry house, I basically was this armchair quarterback. I would just sit there and criticize him all the time in my mind, usually just to myself, sometimes to other people. And it's like, oh, you didn't do this right. You didn't confront that person right. That's the topic for this meeting that we're having right now. What about this? Oh, you know, you don't know your word well enough. You're not very spiritual. I noticed the sin the other day that you committed. And, you know, it was just this, like, you know, you didn't confront me right, even though you were right. That's the best, man. And you didn't respond well to my poor response to your confrontation. Oh. And then one day he had to go out of town for the weekend. He was like, hey, can you be in charge of, you know, we had a study group on Friday nights that a bunch of us guys did. And then we also, all the guys that lived in that house would get together for this like house meeting each weekend. And I was like, yeah, no problem. So, you know, I went in there and it was just like the worst cell group we'd ever had. I had no idea what to do. I felt completely at a loss. I felt really stupid, and it was just a miserable night. I think I called the whole thing off early. And then the same thing happened at this house meeting I was supposed to lead. And boy, when he got back into town, I came to him with hat in hand, apologizing and saying, I'm so sorry for my attitude toward you over the past several months. And I had no idea how hard it was to actually step up and do something rather than sit back and criticize every little fault. It really wasn't until a couple years later, I remember sitting at this guy's bachelor party, that I realized how much I missed out on an opportunity to build a friendship with him. Because instead of appreciating the love that he was trying to show me, I was just sitting there with my arms crossed, and I really missed out on that. I remember sitting there with tears, realizing you were a better man than I was in that whole situation. And I determined, I don't want to do that anymore. I don't want to be that way. I want to do what Paul's saying here, which is to appreciate, honor the people, anybody that's trying to serve the Lord is worthy of a round of applause. And so what does it mean to esteem your leaders? I came up with a few ideas. One is to be inclined to go their direction, not to sit there and make them prove every decision, every leadership decision that they make, but kind of an eagerness to go along with the direction that the leaders might be setting. Also appreciating their work, recognizing what they have done, that there's a reason why they're in that position. And this kind of goes along with being inclined to go their direction. You know, they're probably there for a reason. They probably know at least somewhat what they're doing. And that's why somebody else put them in leadership in this group. And maybe you should have a little bit of confidence in that. There's a benefit of the doubt that needs to be given to leaders. Not just instantly assuming that the motives are bad. You know, there's going to be times in leadership where you've got to make calls. I've had to do this where I'm like, you know, I know that this looks like this is self-serving, this direction that I'm setting here, but I'm just telling you, this is not about me. This is about what is best for the church and in most cases for everybody involved. I mean, you can't always please everybody, right? But you can always try to do what is going to benefit the most people and be best for the most people and for the church as a whole. And so maybe giving the benefit of the doubt, maybe at least asking first instead of attacking first. When you disagree with something that they did or when you heard a story about something they said. Deferring on judgment calls in areas that the Bible doesn't speak directly to. There's a lot of judgment calls that go into Christian leadership. Somebody's got to make those. That's one of the areas of authority that's delegated to Christian leaders. There's just certain judgment calls that have to be made for the functioning of a Christian community. And the leaders, are deemed to be the most reliable, spiritually mature people there, and so that's delegated to them. Don't give them unnecessary flack. Don't be a pain in the butt unnecessarily. And feel free to question. This is not saying you blindly follow along with your leaders. No. Especially in this fellowship, I would hope that we've got an open door policy and we can talk about why decisions were made. I think that's an ideal situation to ask questions about why did we do this and why are we doing that respectfully and try to understand. You know, there's been a lot of times where I've come out of those conversations with somebody who disagreed with the direction that I had made, and we had a conversation about why that decision was made. And we actually both came up with a third way that neither of us had thought of that was actually better. And so esteeming leaders would involve things like this. This kind of general attitude here is what he's talking about. And finally, he says, live in peace with one another. Seems a little bit strange to stick it here in this passage on leadership. But one of the things you realize is that groups without strong leadership, they do tend to lack cohesion. You know, I mean, there are branches of Christianity that basically believe that leadership is unbiblical at all. And groups like that, they never seem to get anything done. Everybody kind of wanders out in their own direction. Somebody ends up rising forward and taking leadership anyway. And the problem is it's usually the person with the strongest personality and not necessarily the person who's the most spiritual. And this group may have been suffering from this. Some lack of strong leadership and a lack of respect for leadership. I'd be willing to bet that some of these leaders were trying to weigh in on these issues that Paul is talking about, like the sexual immorality in this group, like the fact that some of them needed to go get a job. And I imagine that some of the people in this group didn't like that too much, and it was causing division in this group, or at least there were seeds of that. And so, ultimately, though, every member is responsible for peace. This is something he charges the whole group with. And leaders are there. They're especially responsible to try to bring about peace in the group. You know, if you remember that example from Acts chapter 6, where the apostles appointed spiritual leaders that I referred to earlier, you know, their solution to disunity was, we need more leaders. We need to have the church full of people who are spiritually mature, who've taken personal responsibility for the unity of the group as a whole. And they can be just kind of, you know, without anybody else ever knowing about it, helping resolve disputes, helping people work toward unity and love, not allowing conflicts just to run rampant, bitterness to just burn through everything, but urging people to forgive, urging people to resolve, and urging people to love one another. So let's draw some conclusions here. Spiritual leadership might leave you asking this question here. Who can be a spiritual leader? And the answer is you. You know, Paul says in 1 Timothy chapter 3, verse 1, that if anybody aspires to the office of eldership, it's the highest leadership level that the New Testament lays out. That's a really a noble thing that you can do, that you can aspire to. It's praised to step forward as a leader, especially if you understand what leadership really is about, this Christian view of leadership that Christ taught. Leaders, in fact, are badly needed. Jesus said to his disciples, he says, you need to pray that the Lord of the harvest would send workers forth into his harvest. Because he says the harvest is plentiful, the workers are few. Jesus says, I got acres and acres of apple trees that need picked. The problem is I don't got any pickers. And so he says, why don't you pray to the Lord of the apple harvest that he would send apple pickers out into that harvest? So, this is something where there is always a desperate need for good Christian leaders. And I've always been of the convictions that if the leaders are there, the church is basically going to go right up to the size of that container, you know. However many leaders there are and however high quality the leaders there are, that's basically the invisible wall around the container that church can grow out to a healthy size. And so you got to consider the possibility that God might be calling on you to lead. Maybe the reason he brought you here tonight, the reason he brought up this passage right here, is because God wants you to step forward as a worker for the harvest. Maybe you are actually the answer to somebody else's prayer. The prayer that Jesus told them to pray to God, that he would send forth workers for the harvest. And if you think that might be the case, one thing you need to do is you need to get equipped. You need to learn your Bible. You know, Christian leadership, it's leadership, and it's all surrounding God's truth. And so we're going to need to know God's truth. We're going to need to know God's word. We're also going to need to know not just, you know, what's in there, but how to apply it in everyday life. And so there may be a lengthy equipping process that you need to undergo, or maybe you're kind of in an equipping process right now. Maybe you're in a class, but you're not taking it that seriously. Your heart's not in it. Maybe you need to get your heart into it. Maybe you need to start trying, putting forth effort. Maybe you need to begin to just start serving other people. That's the other thing. It's like you don't wait until you're just like this amazing spiritual person before you step out and serve anybody. But you start to serve long before you're amazing or spiritual. And God will grow you. God will change you as you step out and serve him. God will guide you along the way. And, you know, part of it is, to step out and fail. That's actually can be pretty good for your spiritual growth. Because then you're driven back onto the grace of God. You're driven back into the arms of Christ. And you have to look back to him for why do I matter? And why am I doing this? And where is my power for this coming from? So, spiritual leadership. Why don't we just spend a couple minutes in prayer? Yeah, Lord, I really agree with that prayer. I bet you that most of us here in this room would have that same story that I don't know if I would even be here today if it weren't for godly, loving, sacrificial, spiritual leaders, Lord, who got into my life at key times, God, all along the way. Not perfectly. Thank you, Lord, even for that. That you don't require perfection to be used, for us to be used in each other's lives. But you do require us to make ourselves willing, Lord, and to seek to follow you and to seek to depend on you as we do it. Thanks, Lord, that even though there's no way we can consider ourselves adequate as having anything as coming from ourselves, you say in 2 Corinthians 3 that our adequacy comes from you, you who have made us adequate as servants of a new covenant. I pray we can believe that, Lord, for those of us that are already trying to lead for you. And I pray, God, that for those of us that are thinking about this, Lord, some of us here who you are calling forward into leadership, God, I pray that those people, I pray that they would be willing to think about Christ's leadership, how much he loved them even when he didn't have to, how much he gave up to lead them. And I pray that they would respond to his love and to his leadership and seek to feed his sheep like he called on Peter to do and like he calls on every single one of us to do. Most of all, Lord, I pray that we can do all of this under your grace, never beating ourselves up and just thinking how because I'm not perfect that all hope is lost, just realizing that we're going to make mistakes and that you love us and you forgive us and that we can, in fact, because of that, Lord, have the humility to give grace to other people. Amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.